Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
And welcome to episode 4 of the Forgot My Dice podcast. I'm your moderator, Jonathan Edwards, and with me, of course, is Mr. Robert Lundgren. How you doing?
Is my catchphrase now hello, hello? Because I think that's what I say every time. Hello, hello!
It's always good to have catchphrases.
Yeah.
It's going to make it really easy to cast you in an 80s sitcom. Well, I'd like to thank everybody, first and foremost, for all the awesome feedback that we got on the last episode. We've gotten some remarkably cool feedback. It was so neat to actually have that RPG session actually make it into the episode.
Yeah, it was really neat to get that in the game. And I think you and I were already talking about doing something like that for Cthulhu Confidential when it comes out sometime this December. So we hopefully will do that more often. But yeah, that was really
cool. We've talked about Cthulhu Confidential on a number of other systems, and I've actually been talking to a couple other designers who would like to come on the show and do sessions like that. So if that's something you're interested in, definitely let us know, because we had a ton of fun doing it, and I think both of us really think it came out well.
Yeah. Although it was a bear to edit that. Oh my! I did the editing on that segment, and let me just tell you, if you think during a 70s cop show segment that you should do the 70s in the background for half of it, don't. It's a pain in the butt to edit out. Just stop. That was my lesson learned. On the site a couple weeks ago, we had a review of Planeshift Zendikar and the Zendikar art book. So go check it out if either of those things sound interesting to you.
Which is gorgeous, by the way. You did bring it over that one day, and it is absolutely striking.
Yeah. No, I really like Zendikar. Don't get me wrong, Innistrad's pretty rad too, but Zendikar really has its own feel to it. If you like Dark Sun World D&D players, check out Zendikar, because where Dark Sun is post-apocalyptic due to the death of nature, Zendikar is post-apocalyptic because nature has run amok, and it is a nice sort of counterpoint to that setting if you're looking for something post-apocalyptic D&D, but a little different. So yeah, check that out. My thoughts on it, or I should say our thoughts, because Gina helped out actually quite a bit on that one.
Yeah, there's lots of cool stuff in that world. They've done a really good job of fleshing it out, and it's a really neat playground to have an adventure in.
Lastly, I want to give a shout out to my wife, who drawed us a piece of art for the podcast, which was a lot of fun. She drew our characters. She drew Chuck and Keller.
Yes, and it was awesome. Just so perfect for the episode.
Yes, I liked it quite a bit. And yeah, she did it, you know, 30% of the time while feeding babies. I mean, it was pretty cool that she got that all together.
I can tell the boys are getting older, because you're returning to your regularly scheduled madness.
Yeah. Well, they're starting to sleep. They don't sleep through the night. They wake up two or three times at this point, but they get a good 5-hour stretch in when the sun goes down. So you know, we should be safe for recording.
That's as good as gold at that age.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more awake. It might have something to do with the coffee I drank, because I made a pot of half calf, and then I poured myself. I have a Dragon Age Inquisition like beer flagon. I use it as a coffee mug because I don't drink beer. Yeah, I drank that of a half calf, and I realized I basically just drank like 3 cups of coffee. You know, it's just there were 6 in the flagon. So half calf and then half full calf. So I'm probably shouldn't have more caffeine tonight. So I'm just drinking good old fashioned water.
Well, let's roll the dice and see how it affects the rest of the episode. And to that end, let's go ahead and get to Off the Shelf, which is our segment where we talk about all the wonderful things that we've had off the shelf. Or in the case of the last couple of episodes, because of Robert's twins, it's all the wonderful stuff I have off the shelf. And occasionally Robert chimes in. But, yes. Robert, you actually got a chance to play a game. You came over, and we played some Vikings on Board.
Yeah, and let me talk about it. Don't take it away from me. This is all I've got.
Well, we talked about it a little in the last episode with Mike, so bring us up to speed. What are we dealing with here?
So Vikings on Board is your standard issue work replacement meeple game, and it's got a lot of little clever tricks. I really liked the turn order thing.
Yeah, isn't that cute?
Which is probably impossible to describe, but I know you'll try.
I'll try.
You'll
so
try.
On the side of the board is a section where basically a dock worker stands, and he goes either on the right side, which is a line of open spaces that are each associated with a different action, or on the left side of these actions. And based on where that guy stands, you take your workers and you move them from one side of the dock to the other as you select action. So that means that every action can only be used once, and that's kind of a big part of the strategy, because depending on where that action sits on the dock also determines your turn order for the next turn. So you can definitely construct a situation where you go first. In fact, that's one of the actions you can take, is I want to go first the next round, so you burn an action to be first. But you can definitely have a situation where one player will take all of their turns and then the other player will take their turn, because some of the stronger actions are, you know, push you back in the order of play. Robert, what did you think of all that? I just thought it was a brilliant little system.
I like that turn order. I thought that was brilliant. Like just seeing the little dude, because he like hopscotches across the dock, you know, because if he's on the right, then you're putting your guys on the right. And if he's on the left, then you're putting your guys on the left. And it was like ingenious. So I was looking at that and
it's another layer of strategy too, right? Because then you have not only the strategy of what action am I going to take, but how am I going to pay for that in the next round? Is that going to advance me in the number of turns, or is that going to cost me by pushing me back in the turn order?
Yeah. And sometimes you're setting something up and you realize, oh, I got to hit this one out of the park early on, or you could take the thing I want to do. So that's when you go like, oh, maybe I should just burn a guy and just take the first spot. I don't know. It was ingenious. It was. Yeah. Like you guys talked a lot about the component quality and all that. But that the game itself is just ingenious. Like it's
clever. Yeah. It's clever. It's a very basic game. We're talking about a very small number of actions, and they're all relatively close to one another, so it's a very easy to learn game, but there's a surprising amount of depth.
Yeah, and then the components are just kind of like they're cute, they're rad, you know, you build these little ships, and then, you know, and some of them can be short and some of them can be long, and then they set sail. It's darling. And then one ship doesn't have a butt, and it's like, oh, that ship will never go.
Yeah, I think overall, this has been quite the surprise for me. I didn't really expect a lot out of it. I bought it because it created such a wave of good tidings at Gen Con, and I'm really glad that I bought it, because it's so far, it's just been an absolute pleasure to play.
Well, I'm glad you bought it, because then I got to play it.
There you go. So that's Vikings on Board. We'll probably review it here in the future once we get a chance to play it a couple more times together.
And we'll have to drag the wife in next time. Yeah.
Actually, that's a really good point to bring up. I'm glad that you said that, because I think this is one of those games that it's easy enough to teach and the components are inviting enough that I think this is a game that you can really use to hook new gamers, people that aren't used to hobby gaming.
Well, my wife is far from a new gamer. I was just thinking, you have that high dining room table and we can play it pretty easily while holding a baby in one arm.
Yes. Well, that is true. That is true. In fact, we proved that, because you and I each had a baby while we were playing.
That's true. That's true. Because Gina was drawing.
Exactly.
I was cracking the art whip on her because she had to get done.
While we're on the subject of board games, I did have a chance to play a couple other games. I played
a couple implies two.
This is 2 weeks eight. Worth of stuff, and oftentimes we'll play two or three games in one night, right?
Right.
So don't let the list intimidate you.
I'm just saying, man. You said a couple, and I'm seeing like eight. So you played an octet.
Well, the first thing that I got the chance to get back out on the table, something we've talked about before, and that's the Pathfinder Adventure Card Game. So we're playing through the Skull and Shackles set, which is the second core set. And yes, it's all about pirates. And so far, we've been having a great, great time with it. It's just like the first Pathfinder Adventure Card Game, with some new and rebalanced character classes. You know, it's a charming little game. It's super fun. One thing I really like about it is it's very much a co-op game. You have to work together to really make things happen. And that's a pinnacle when it comes to a game. Now, the Skull and Shackles version also introduces having a pirate ship. And sometimes you'll have to battle other ships with your ship. And I'm kind of hit or miss as to whether it works or not. It's got a weird function during play where whoever's turn it is currently commanding the ship. And so it doesn't really make a lot of sense, because the ship is magically in all of the places that your characters are. And so, I mean, from a thematic perspective, it kind of breaks. But from a gameplay perspective, it's kind of a neat mechanic. So I'm kind of split as to whether I like that aspect of it or not.
You're playing the third one, if I'm not mistaken, and that's when game designers get to that point, that's usually when they try something new, because you know they produce the first one, and then the second one they really kind of solidify, you know, what they wanted to do with the first one, and then the third one is when they start getting bored and it's like, well, what can we do? Oh, I know, frickin' pirates. And then the next one is is it the World Wound, I think?
No, next is Wrath of the Righteous.
That's right. It's the one where the Pathfinder RPG incorporated their mythic level thing in, so you become like basically demigods in the course of that one. So I'm sure that has its own wrinkle where you get supernaturally crazy powers in that one.
I do have it sitting here in my office, and I opened it up just to kind of take a look at the components. I haven't read through the rule book yet. I wanted to finish the Skull and Shackles campaign my friends and I are doing first, but I will say that one of the first things I noticed when I opened it up is that it comes with a punch-out board full of chits that seem to signify that there's a brand new mechanic at play, because those chits are not present in either of the previous versions.
Yep, there you go. So what else have you been playing? On the list is one of my favorites, actually.
Zombie Dice? Yes, I actually introduced Carlos and Chloe, my two oldest, to Zombie Dice, and we had an absolute blast playing it. We sat there for almost 45 minutes just rolling dice. It was awesome.
You know what? Not to make my kid sound cooler than your kid, but I'm going to do it. I played that with my oldest, who's almost five, and she got it. Like, she really got it. That game's so easy. And she won because, like, at 5 years old, like, they have no comprehension of push your luck. She's like, oh, I got two shots. I'll just bank. And we're like, yeah, let it ride! And losing. And yeah, she just turtle in the hair that thing. You know, slow and steady won the race. I played her a couple times, and she's won more often than not with that childlike strategy. And I'm like, oh!
Yeah, it's you know, it's one of those games that I had been meant to show them a lot earlier, and it just... It's that tiny little package, so it has a tendency to get lost in the shuffle.
Yes.
I'm really glad that we sat down and played it, because we had a blast doing it. And it's kind of interesting because the kids' personalities really show through in the way they approach the game. Because Chloe is methodical and slow and doesn't like to get the three shotgun shells. And I guess we should take a moment to kind of explain the game. It's a push-your-luck dice game. And there's three types of dice. There's green, red, and yellow. And they have a different mix of brains, footsteps, and shotgun blasts. And you play a zombie. And the game is you take three dice out, you roll them, and you're trying to collect a total of 15 brains on the dice. Now, the colors are important because they tell you what the mix is. The red dice have more shotgun blasts than anything else, and the green dice have more brains than anything else. And you just keep pushing your luck, and at any time you can stop rolling and bank the number of brains that you have in your quest to get 15. So Chloe is very methodical and slow, and she'll get as many brains as she can, and as soon as she gets two shotgun blasts, she always banks her brains and moves on. And Carlos is the opposite. He's like Eowyn. He's like, I'm going to let her ride. I want all the brains.
No. Eowyn was like Chloe. I was letting it ride.
Oh, it was the other way around.
Yeah, no, she would get one shotgun shell, and she'd be like, nope, I'm out. And I'm like, really?
Yeah,
really,
it's
honey?
It's funny. Yeah, well, Carlos is the same way as you then, because he's just chucking the dice. He's like, two shotgun blasts. You know what? I'm going to try again. Why not? Let's see. We've talked about it before on the show, but I also got an opportunity to play a little bit of Splendor, and you and I have played that before. That's a fun engine-building game, and it never gets old. I've been playing it for years, and it's a standby favorite in the house. I also had an opportunity to get together with some of my buddies and play some Dice Masters a couple weeks ago, and we had a blast with that.
Is that why I haven't seen you as much lately? Are you, like, scratching your neck and little hollowed out in the cheeks from your dice crack?
Well, we're doing a bi-weekly Dice Masters night, so once every 2 weeks we get together, and there's four of us, and between the four of us, I think we have established decks from every single release now. And it's a neat game because there's so much flexibility. You have to select from the random draws, a hand of eight character cards, and these character cards can differ based on their rarity, and the more rare they are, the more powerful they are, but they come at a higher cost, of course. And then you have to build your pool of dice from that, and the actual gameplay mechanic is really quite clever and fun, so I've been having a real blast with it. had a chance to sit down and play a game of Elder Signs that same night. And Elder Signs is another dice game, but this is all based in the Cthulhu mythos, and it's from Fantasy Flight Games. And in this one, you play a bunch of characters who are researching the shenanigans that are happening at a variety of different locations, and you roll dice as you're trying to find the right clues to basically disable the Ancient One's ability to get into the Earth. I've kind of oversimplified it there. That's just a very basic way of looking at it, but it's a cool game with cool components and a lot of really good expansions out, so that continues to be a fun one to revisit. And then finally, on the board game front, I had a chance to play a game that I played at ChupacabraCon earlier this year, and that is from Fireside Games, and it's called Dastardly Dirigibles. And this is a neat, neat little game. Kind of a little on the basic side, but what you have is a layout of a dirigible in five parts. You've got a nose, a tail, two center sections, and an engine section. Maybe it's six parts. I can't remember if it's five or six. These sections are empty, and you get a hand of cards, and every round you play one card, and you basically put down a part on your dirigible. And that forces the other player to put down a part on their dirigible if they have the same thing. Now, there's multiple different types of dirigibles in these cards, and so you get bonuses for set collection, basically, and building a single type of dirigible. And the first person to finish their dirigible starts the scoring phase, and then you score based on what you have in front of you. Now, what's interesting, like I was saying, is that there's a lot of cards that basically let you poke the other player and force them to do something they don't want to do. But also, if you put down a part and they have that part, they have to put that down. So you could basically ruin their day intentionally by playing a part that forces them to basically scrap their set. And that's really neat.
That sounds like fun.
It's a really good game that has that nice fine balance between playing your own hand while poking your opponent, but not overly so, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. It sounds like, though, it will fail the holding a baby test, so we will have to put that one on hold for a little bit. But it does sound interesting. I want to play it later.
Yeah, that would be Baby in a Front Pack, which needs to be a stamp that you can put on the game. it can be a symbol right next to the player count and the age suggestion. Holding a baby, Baby in the Front Pack, or Baby in the Crib, which would be like an Arkham Horror.
Exactly. So have you watched anything on the on cathode ray television tube?
I have. So I've continued my Person of Interest consumption. I'm now halfway through season three. Things are definitely getting very interesting.
Yeah.
I like how things that unfold in season two and season three were not just some clever idea they came up in the writing room, because they've been hinting at them since the very first episode.
It's like they had a plan, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I respect a TV show for doing that, because so often the TV shows fly off the handle looking at you, Arrow. And
looking at you, Lost.
Yeah. And completely manufacture this cockamamie nonsense and try and pass it off as a long-term plot plan. No. You know what happened? You ran out of ideas. You wrote yourself into a corner, and now you're stuck with the nonsense.
So, well, speaking of the Arrowverse, I'll chime in and say I finished up Supergirl Season 1, prepping for the Season 2 on the CW. That show, God, like, I kept watching it, even though I was kind of, like, hate-watching it at some point, because, like, I really, really liked the main cast, and a lot of people, like, really grew into their parts in interesting ways, although some didn't, but, like, the Cat Grant character and Supergirl and her sister and all that, like, those were very engaging characters. But, man, I don't know where they found the villains, but the villains were terrible. I don't know.
I've got it on my list of things to watch. I've got to get caught up with it. But between watching Person of Interest and continuing to chip away at The Next Generation, and also the new season of Longmire came out on Netflix, which I'm a big fan of that show, I've just not had time to fold it in. It's next on my queue.
Well, I'll tell you this. I watched it all the way through, and it does keep getting better as they go along. So, like I said, I've got hope. It's just it wasn't like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. getting better, where about halfway through the season they figured it out and they the show was pretty good after that. It's definitely been a slower climb, but hopefully moving to the CW will fix things for the better. And hopefully they do something to jam that universe into the Arrowverse, because having metahumans and aliens would be awesome.
Well, they're already working on it, because they have crossovers. And this year they're supposed to have the crossover with Flash and Arrow, and apparently Legends of Tomorrow is going to make a showing as well.
Well, I'm hoping they just jam the whole universe together, like they have some sort of crisis on Infinite Earths, and it's just like, no, it's all one place now. Have you watched anything else?
Well, that's about it for TV, but I did manage to get a couple movies in.
Well, hold on. I got one more thing on the TVs then.
Fire away.
I have got, I haven't finished up. We're almost done with Luke Cage.
Oh, don't tell me a thing. That's on my
list. I'm not going to tell you a thing.
I got Supergirl and Luke Cage after I finish my Longmire.
Yeah, I put Person of Interest on hold because I wanted to watch Luke Cage. But yeah, Luke Cage is very good. I was never a big fan of Luke Cage. I mean, obviously, because in the 70s he was Power Man and he wore that goofy suit with the tiara. But when he took over the Avengers in, I forget what arc that ended up happening in, but that's one of the arcs where I started reading the Avengers for the first time about 10 years ago. I really liked Luke Cage. And then when Jessica Jones came out, I went back and read Alias, and he's in that quite a bit too. And you know, I kind of gained an appreciation for the character in the comics there, because I he was just interesting, because he's you know how a lot of superheroes like enjoy being superheroes.
No, he's definitely reticent to be a superhero.
Yeah, I don't think he hates it, but it's not what he necessarily wants to be. You know, he just does it because he's good at it. You know, I don't know. I just. The character's interesting, and they definitely captured that in the show. Like, the show is very, very good, and it's
well, so, I mean, certainly Netflix has not failed us yet. How about on the video game front, Robert? Have you gotten a chance to play any video games?
Gosh, I have. It's amazing. I played, count it, 4 games of Overwatch in the past 2 weeks.
Most I'm going to have to get back into Overwatch soon, because they've got the Halloween boxes coming out soon.
Yes. I saw someone posted a video on the YouTubes that some of the skins have gotten leaked, which I don't know why I'm going to go watch that directly after we get done recording this. But I am, even though that event is probably launching like tomorrow. Like, we're talking about this like, oh, it's not out yet. And by the podcast,
they've hinted at a few of the skins already in the Winston full motion video that got released a while back on YouTube. Both Mercy and I believe May can be seen in Halloween costumes.
Mercy is in a witch costume in the background of one thing. So yeah. Oh, and Torbjorn is dressed up like a Viking, because of course he is. So we'll see if this YouTube video I'm going to watch is BS or if it's real. Gentle listener, you've probably already been playing this for a week, and I apologize. But yes, for us, it is in the future. Intangible, something we cannot grasp yet.
And then you also had you were telling me about a demo that you played that's going to make you buy a new game.
I bought it. I pre-ordered it. And no less, it goes live pretty much right when we get done podcasting. And even though I got to be up to get my kid to school, I am very much thinking, why adults when you could play a game at 11 o'clock at night? So it's called Dragon Quest Builders. And on the package, you're going to think it's like, oh, it's a mashup of Dragon Quest and Minecraft, but it's a little bit more nuanced than that. I don't know. It like they threaded this needle very interestingly. So it's set in the very first Dragon Quest or Dragon Warrior game, that's what it was released as originally here. At the end of it, when you go face down the big bad, he goes like, you know, hey, bro, why instead of fighting me, why don't we just rule this realm of Elfgard together and we'll just split it down the middle? And in the original game, if you say yes, it just says you guys take over the world, and then he kills you, and then you get a game over scream. And if you say no, then you fight the last boss like you should. Well, in this game, the hero said yes, and the world got destroyed. And so it's kind of like retelling the first Dragon Warrior game, except when you roll into a new town like you do, you know, in those RPGs, it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, I've leveled up here. I got to go to a new town. The new town is in ruins because the bad guy won and destroyed the world. And so you have to spend some time rebuilding the town, and you can build rooms, and then people will move in because people have been like, you know, reduced to a state of barbarism and they live out in the fringes. But you start building these towns and bringing the light of, you know, the sun back, and people start like flocking to your villages. And it's really clever, because if you do not like Minecraft, you do not have to get all obsessed about stuff, because you can just build things very simply. I mean, you don't even have to put roofs on buildings. You just have to have, you know, rooms that are 2 blocks high and just put stuff in them. And it's like, oh, you've got a forge in a room with a door. Ta-da! You have a smith. So if you don't care about that, you can just do it. You can just crank out all these buildings and not care. And then, but if you do, then you can get all weird and obsessed about it. And then on top of that, it's got a really interesting, it's more of an action RPG, because you run around and you don't get into like turn-based combat like in an RPG. It's more like Diablo. You just run into monsters and whack at them. And, uh-huh. You know, and there's crafting involved, because you got to, of course, it's like Minecraft. You got to build stuff and gather some resources. But it's not as it's not as hardcore as Minecraft was. It's a little bit more easier, but it kind of lets you obsess about things as much as you want to, which is a nice change. So I don't know. I played the heck out of the demo and it was amazing. And the demo ended and I was really sad. And I pulled out my $60. I have a rule. I don't buy games new because, you know, in 3-4 months, there will be a sale.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, but I broke my rule because I'm like, I got done with the demo and I'm like, oh, I just got to go to this next island where I can make a hammer. And I plopped it down. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm going to buy this.
Well, it is the time of year for new games, and I have had a chance to play 3 new games in the last couple weeks. Forza Horizon 3 came out, and I am a huge, huge car fanatic, so for me, that's just like putting out bait. I mean, I just can't stop myself. I picked up Forza Horizon 3, and I have to say I'm having a blast with it. It's a super fun game. I also got a copy of XCOM 2. And that I was a big fan of XCOM 1 when it came out, so it's just a natural extension. Nothing is knocking my socks off. There's not a lot of new gameplay here, but it's still that solid strategic gameplay, and it's just a lot of fun, and I like where they're taking the story. The story is actually kind of interesting, so I'll let you know how that one shapes up, but the first initial impact is pretty positive. And then finally, Gears of War 4 just came out over the last couple days for early access. And I have to say, it's kind of a mixed bag. It doesn't look quite like an Xbox One game. I would have expected it to look a little sharper, which is not to say that it looks bad. It still looks really good. It's just I would have expected a higher amount of detail from an Xbox One game. That said, it plays and feels just like a Gears of War game, and they do some interesting stuff with the story. And for those of us who have read a lot of the extended fluff, it's kind of neat because they're really paying a lot of homage to the extended universe. The very first mission takes place in Aspho Fields, which is a major offensive that happens before the Locust War starts. It's kind of neat because the first tutorial level is basically you in Aspho Fields as a no-name soldier, but you're with one of the main character's brother, who is never introduced in the games, is only introduced in the book. So you can tell that these people are definitely steeped in the Gears of War extended lore. So I'm having a good time with that. And then finally, I got my soon-to-be wife and both of my oldest kids into a game called Overcooked. And it's a 4-player co-op game, couch co-op. And everybody's in a kitchen, and you're trying to work together to make orders. But the kitchen is awfully cramped and generally is in odd shape. And so it forces you to communicate to get things done. And it's simultaneously clever and neat because you can play with other people, and you might end up hating everybody in your life because they've let you down one too many times in that kitchen.
Oh, I might have to play that with my 5-year-old. That's
yeah,
not going to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you'll have a good time, but there's times where you're like, just make the bread, make the bread, put the bread on the plate, put the bread on the plate. I need bread. It brings out the Gordon Ramsay in everybody.
Oh, and that's how you make 5-year-olds cry. Well, I also have been partaking of a few podcasts because I've been trying to expand my repertoire. I just want to give a shout out to Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff, episode 210. There is a segment in there about how to keep your GM motivated, you know, putting the burden on the players. And it's like, you know, the GM it's not always up to us GMs to make sure that the game flies. Sometimes the players have to do a little input too. It was just a real interesting talk about that. And yeah, it's one of those things. I was listening to it and I was like, my players kind of do this already, but it was interesting hearing them talk about it and having words to express what makes a good player from a GM's point of view. I don't know. The segment was amazing. Get done with us and then go listen to that because it was very good. And then I was listening to a podcast called Advantage to Insight, and they were doing a series talking about some of the older D&D second edition out of print campaign settings. And they've only done a couple at this point. I think I've listened to all of them at this point. But anyway, I got my head so far up the butt of second edition D&D that I could definitely talk about that. So if anybody out there thinks that would be an interesting podcast topic, let us know. Because that verges into it's way too old for anybody to care. But if you do care, if that's something you want to hear people, let us know. I will talk about that at length.
And that's what we've had off the shelf in the last 2 weeks. Go ahead and let us know what you've had off the shelf by joining the conversation on all of our digital outputs.
Do you have a tabletop, board game, miniature game, or RPG that you're going to release for retail?
Or do you have an upcoming tabletop Kickstarter that you're about to launch?
We would love to interview you for a future episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Send us an email to fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com to schedule an interview. Now it's time to get into Wisdom of Crowds. This is our section on all of the new tabletop news and Kickstarter. And unfortunately, in this post-Gen Con era, it's kind of a slow month.
You think?
So everybody saves up their news, and then Gen Con comes along. Everybody makes these huge, huge announcements.
Just vomits it all over us.
Yeah, and then everybody goes silent running until the holiday season because it's just... Oh, man, it was painful looking for news this week.
Yeah, it was. But we got some fine stories.
Yes, let's talk about the few items that we were able to find.
Yeah, we sifted through a lot of crap. not a lot of crap, just a lot of like, oh, hey, there's just going to be this new game in 7 months. And it's like, that's super. We'll talk closer to 7 months from now.
Well, FFG was in the news last time for their breakup with Games Workshop. And now they're back in the news. And this time
did they get the Twitter set? Were they sending nasty Instagrams at each other?
I think what we're dealing with here maybe is the rebound.
Oh my.
You know, FFG's rebounding from Games Workshop with the folks that publish Mutant Chronicles Siege of the Citadel.
Basically, the Kickstarter sensation, which made a ton of money. Is it still going on right now? It finished? Okay. I checked it a couple days ago. But yeah, it did pretty well. And I know why FFG liked it. It looks like there's a lot of tokens in that box. they're going to pick up the distribution deal for them. So the guys who make that board game don't have to, you know, sort of waste their time getting all that pesky business stuff done, which I'm sure is a pain in the butt. So they're going to be doing distribution, localization to foreign markets, and then obviously retail distribution will all be handled by FFG. Good game to pick up. I mean, yeah, the Mutant Chronicles. Our guest last time really wanted to talk about it, but we covered it in detail two episodes ago. But yeah, he's a big fan.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to like there. It's an interesting world. Next up on the news is Wizards of the Coast. They're back in the news again, and this time they've put up an interesting little survey about this revised Ranger class that they put out.
Yeah, we talked about it last time where you thought some of the abilities sounded overpowered, and I thought some of them sounded just fine. Well, now our opinions matter.
Yes.
You can go take the survey and tell them what you think of the new Ranger.
Are they publishing results on the survey? I haven't had a chance to go look yet.
They don't publish them publicly. Typically, when they post a new survey, they talk about the last one and what they found out. And they usually talk about it in broad terms. For example, they did a survey actually about D&D campaign settings like that. In general, like what you would like to see them publish again. That one they got specific about where they said about 40% of the people play Homebrew, about 30% play Forgotten Realms, and then the remainder is every other setting they've ever made. And the top 20% of that is split up between Ravenloft, Dark Sun, and I want to say Planescape. Mm-hmm. I forget which one. But I mean, so they got specific on that, but then, you know, on some of the other ones, they just say it's like, oh, hey, you liked it. So it's like, oh. So, yeah, they don't, like, publish, like, the hard numbers. It's like, well, this class feature got 77%. So
I would just be curious to see if folks were thinking more along your lines or my lines on that.
Well, that's something they would probably go into, because the next time they publish a survey in it is October, so that would be November. They'll probably just mention it. Like, it's like, oh, things were good, but this feature seemed bad or whatever. But, yeah, they're not going to get into, like, the hard numbers.
I do have to give them credit where credit is due. The fact that they are actually seeking out this kind of feedback from the community, it really shows how invested they are in making sure that D&D 5th really is the best that it can be.
It's awful because I want stuff, but I'm kind of digging that there's not a lot of rule books out, because I'm looking at Pathfinder and just making a character. I mean, yes, you can make a character out of that core rule book, but, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a gamer. And when it's like, well, I can build my race and my class and pick a subclass that's unique and blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, now I'm staring down like six rule books.
Yeah, I have a buddy of mine who's starting a new online campaign. He asked me to join in, and he sent me the list of things that you can and can't do. And he's completely restricted everybody to just the core rulebook and the advanced player handbook, because he does not think that most people have access to the full library, and he's probably right. Now, I'll let you know how it goes as we start to construct characters and whatnot. I'll keep everybody abreast of it. But it's kind of neat. He's doing, in honor of October, he's doing a... gothic setting.
Oh, fun.
And so it'll be kind of cool. I'm thinking of building something along the lines of like a vampire or a witch hunter. Well, since we brought Pathfinder up, we can talk about Pathfinder in the news, because they have a new retail incentive for the Pathfinder Society.
Yeah, and this one isn't stupid.
So we are, of course, talking about retail incentives. So a set of items or gameplay options that publishers will give retailers to give people basically a reason to go into your friendly local game store.
So what they are giving out is, if you go to your Pathfinder Society table and you have the table has collectively spent $10 there, they get a passive buff for the rest of the game. And if the table has collectively spent $50 at the store that day, they get a better buff. The incentive you get is, if you spend $10, you get 5 points added to your con when determining if hit point damage would kill you. And for $50, everybody at the table gets 10 extra points of effective constitution. And then you can also choose one of the following: cheaper healing, recover from wounds, or bonus wealth. So, yeah, just, you know, something simple, but just giving you a reason to, like, try to minimax your dollars. And I'll say this, during 4th edition, Wizards kind of dabbled in this idea too. And what they came up with was, because it's Wizards of the Coast and they make magic, they're like, oh, like, gamers like cards, right? So we'll just make, like, a package of cards that will have, you know, one-use powers, like, you know, 4th edition love their powers. And then, you know, you can buy them and then use them during D&D, or, well, I don't remember what Adventurers League was called, but whatever Adventurers League was called back then, I think it was Encounters, actually, you can just use it during that. And, like, I read that, and I'm like, Wizards, I love you, Wizards, but that's a real bad idea. Because I don't know if you know this, Wizards, but there is a healthy segment of role-playing people that do not like cards.
We both know how important it is that if you go to a shop and use their space, you really should be paying, I like to call it the table tax. Next up in the news is Steve Jackson Games, and they, of course, are local here to the greater Austin area, which is kind of neat. And Steve Jackson Games is coming out with an oldie but a goodie. They are making a 6th edition of Ogre. And this is a version of the game that actually shares a lot with the recent Kickstarter.
Yeah, it sounds like it gives you everything that was in the Kickstarter, except the box is much tinier and much more square. And so this gigantic, like, 50-pound rectangle that you got from the Kickstarter.
I mean, it's just it's a solid block of cardboard, essentially.
It might as well be that, like, monolith from 2001.
You could very easily make it that
way. Dude, when we make that video, that's what we should do. We should have it sitting up, and we should have, like, the sun and the moon, like, right over it. And it just...
And that is, like, most likely publicly held, too. I don't think we would need to license that.
What, just people screaming into a microphone? It's not hard.
One, well, the da na na da da.
I bought the soundtrack to that stupid movie, and there's like 5 tracks of just that screaming on it. And I'm like, did I need 5 tracks of this? Could we just have one super cut of it, really, please? And it's like, this barely qualifies as music, guys. It's just.
Now let's talk about Ogre for a moment. Ogre, of course, is a miniatures game, is the easiest way to describe it.
An asymmetrical miniatures game. So one player plays not just a tank, sir. It plays a super tank. It plays a tank the size of a city called the Ogre. And they come in a couple different flavors. And then the other player plays basically like space marines, or I don't know what you call them, but, like, you know, ground forces that are trying to blow up the ogre. And the ogre can't, like, move really well. It just sort of stomps across the board. And the other players are trying to deflect it away from things and destroy it if they can before it gets to the other side of the board and off the radar, so to speak.
6th edition. That is a remarkable achievement for a game. And in our final bit of news, we're going to talk a little bit about Renegade Games. They are, of course, a publisher of board games, and they are also doing a incentive to brick and mortar stores. And this is kind of an interesting one. They are actually releasing their games to brick and mortar stores before they release it to online retailers. So it's
so Jonathan, and this is, I'm not asking you this because I haven't read the article that you are talking about yet, because I would not be that unprofessional, but how early are the retailers getting it?
Yeah. I don't know if the article even said that.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, so they're releasing the games a quarter early, approximately, about 3 months. So that's a fair amount.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, they're saying for their test launch, they're basically, you'll get Lantern, or the brick and mortar stores will get Lanterns before the holiday season. But yeah. So I'm assuming that'd be on or around Black Friday is when the brick and mortar stores will get it. But then the actual release of it says quarter one, so January to March. So yeah, probably 2-3 months easily.
Yeah,
that's actually pretty extensive. I mean, Wizards
a really big heads up. No joke.
Yeah, yeah. Like the only other company I know that does that is like Wizards of the Coast, and they give stuff out like 11 days early, and this is months potentially.
Renegade Studios has some neat games too. They've got 1893 World's Fair, and that is a Spiel des Jahres nominee. They've got Lanterns, of course, which we've been talking about. They've also got Fuse, which is this really, really interesting, very fast playing dice game.
They make Double Feature, which is a party game, but it's a lot of fun. And Gravwell is oddly interesting, but you need a lot of people to make it work.
Yeah, true. So yeah, Renegade Games releasing games to brick and mortar stores before online. I think that it's going to be interesting to see how that works out for them. All right, well, let's move on from the news to Kickstarter. And much like the news, Kickstarter has kind of been quiet lately. Now, before we get into the projects, we're going to talk about a Kickstarter that affects folks here in the greater Austin area the most. But if you feel like traveling to Austin, which is always a good idea, this might affect you
as
well.
Have a breakfast taco.
Pardon?
Have a breakfast taco.
Oh, indeed. Breakfast tacos, which is a very Austin thing. You should join us. And I say that because both Robert and I are planning on attending ChupacabraCon, which will be in May of 2017. And they actually have a small Kickstarter going right now. Now, it's kind of neat. They are capable of putting Chupacabra on whether or not this Kickstarter funds. This Kickstarter is simply going to increase the number of guests that they are able to fly in for the con.
Yeah, give them a little scratch earlier on so they can make some arrangements, so to speak.
I attended ChupacabraCon earlier this year, and I can tell you it's a really classy little con. It's a fantastic con. It's perfect for the Austin area. They're starting to run out of room in the location that they're doing it at right now. I think this is probably going to be the last year at that particular location. But there's lots and lots of gaming space, and the tables are always humming with activity. It's a ton of RPG playing, and they have some great RPG guests. In fact, last year they had John Wick, writer of the Seventh Sea.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the guys from Pinnacle were there. So yes. The guys who would do Savage Rifts, basically, which we talked about.
Pinnacle is always well represented there, and as are the guys from Evil Hat. They always have a good showing there, and they bring a lot of awesome, awesome products, and they even come out and GM stuff. Last year, John Wick actually GM'd quite a few sessions, so that's really neat.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I have not had a chance to go to a con in a long time, so I am looking forward to attending this one.
Yes.
So it should be said, the Kickstarter is basically, you're basically buying tickets for the con early. So it's $50 for the basic one, and the tickets when they go to for sale on the website or at the door will be $60. So, you know, save $10, give them a little money early to get some more guests. Not a bad deal.
No, not at all. Not at all. Next up on Kickstarter, we have a project called Illimat. And we actually had to look up the pronunciation on this one.
Yeah. So this has a funny story. So there's a band called the Decemberists, and they decided for a photo shoot that they would kind of roll around to weird locations and play some arcane looking board game with a weird, you know, and their art guys like made up a board game, but it didn't really have rules. And then a few years later, as the band got more and more into board games, they're like, hey, we had that goofy board game and that photo shoot we did. Why don't we make it like a real thing? And so they hired Keith Baker, who I know most from the D&D campaign setting Eberron, and you, Jonathan, probably know better from, and I know this too, from the card game Gloom.
Yes,
but
one of the faves in my house. We really like Gloom here.
Yeah, he's making the rules for Illimat, and I wish I could tell you how it's played because it does look very arcane as well. But the learn how to play video is very long, and I didn't want to watch it because my children were not behaving today. I apologize, gentle listener. But it's got James D'Amato from the One Shot podcast on it and a bunch of other people. So it should be a fun watch. And they got it linked off their Kickstarter page.
Yeah, it's a really nice looking package, too. Just looking at the components that they've pictured here, it's kind of like half tarot deck, half playing card deck.
Well, it's supposed to look kind of like vaguely Victorian. And yeah, you played with cards in Victorian times. Dice were for the common folk, not for a secret society.
Well, it definitely looks interesting. And the price of entry is not terrible. So for $20, you can actually get a tote bag with one of the designs from the game on it. For $45, you can get one copy of Illimat. For $55, you get a copy of Illimat and the stretch goal rewards, and you'll be enrolled in the initial rank of the Society of Luminaries. And you get to receive a pin for having been enrolled. And then it just goes on from there. So if you are a fan of the band, or a fan of the game, or a fan of both, this seems
or
like...
Or Keith Baker, or weird Victorianness.
Now, next up on Kickstarter is The Book of Three Gates by Simon Berman.
Yes. So I'm Facebook besties with Simon Berman. He used to work for Privateer Press. I backed the Book of Starry Wisdom, which was the first Kickstarter he ran, and this is sort of his companion volume for it. So The Book of Three Gates takes what he is calling the H.P. Lovecraft witch cycle, which takes the stories The Dunwich Horror, The Dreams in the Witch House, and The Haunter in the Dark. And then he also gets modern writers to write essays and, you know, other fiction about this stuff, like looking at sort of the mythos and what's going on in that. And I got to say, so I backed The Book of Story Wisdom. It's a nice looking book. And I read some of the essays on it. I've got way too much stuff to read right now. I have not gone through all of it yet. And I'm terrible about reading physical media these days. I don't know what it is.
You're paying there.
But no, they had Adam Scott Glancy, who's one of the guys who did Delta Green. He had a really interesting essay about comparing how the U.S. government treated the prisoners in Innsmouth to the current war on terror, and was drawing allusions and stuff. And then, you know, obviously raising the point of what do we have in Guantanamo Bay? Because, you know, there's some weird parallels here. Duh, duh, duh. Yeah, it was a fun essay. So and the book's really pretty. It's a nice sturdy hardback. It's got, you know, gold leaf and some bookmarks and this cool map on the inside. So yeah, they make high quality stuff.
Yeah, this is an interesting take on the material. I'm very curious to read this myself, and it's got some nice art too. Now, next up, we have a project from the Austin area, so shout out to all you Austin area developers. We always love to see you here on Kickstarter, and this is Infusion, a sci-fi fantasy deck-building game.
So tell me about Infusion.
You know, it's sci-fi, it's deck-building. That tickles a lot of things for me. Looking through the rule set, I have to say that it looks like a four-player Star Realms-style deck-builder. And it tries to infuse a lot of fluff into it. Like, it has a deck of mission cards that you shuffle, and these mission cards come out in a different order every time, and that kind of creates your story for the game. There's a lot of named characters and whatnot in it, which is kind of neat, and they've actually written an extensive backstory and whatnot around it. So it just seems like a deck builder with a little more fluff around it, and it's got some neat art in it, too. Yeah, it looks like it's coming together well. The barrier of entry is not too bad. It's $50 for a copy of the game and all the stretch goals and whatnot. And then you jump up to $275, which is a retailer level for six copies of the game. And there's a $1,000 variant of the pledge that you can get that gets you a bunch of stuff, including the ability to work with their design team to create a hero based on you, essentially. Take a look, if you like deck builders especially, Infusion, a sci-fi fantasy deck building game. It's by Jennifer Wenner. And then finally, Robert, something that I think is might be an essential kit at every gaming night, regardless of RPG or board game, and that is a bottle opener, the Meeple Mate bottle opener.
Is there anything to say about a Meeple Mate bottle opener that is not described in the title?
Well, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's a bottle opener. It's shaped like a meeple. And it has one awesome feature. It actually has a nice, powerful magnet on it, so that when you pop the top off the beverage, the top sticks to the bottle opener so it doesn't go flying off.
like that.
But most importantly, it's shaped like a meeple, which is awesome, especially being the proud father of several meepillows from Top Shelf Fun. They were a Kickstarter from last year, and they're awesome little plushy meeples. This guy, I'm buying two of them, and they will join my fleet of meeple-related paraphernalia. So at this point, with a little under 2 weeks to go, it's fully funded. $16 for one meeple mate, $30 for two meeple mates. Certainly a little pricey for a standard bottle opener, but if you look at the custom size that it is and the fact that it's shaped like a meeple, it kind of explains it. And, you know, as far as bottle openers go, I will say this. This is actually a pretty high-quality bottle opener. And if you've ever tried to use a cheap one to get the lid off of a beverage, it's frustrating. It's worth spending a little extra for a bottle opener. But I used to tend bar, so I could be skewed. So that is the Wisdom of Crowds for this episode. As always, we're always looking for your news tips. Definitely reach out and let us know if there's anything that we should be talking about on the show. And again, as always, check out our show notes for the episode to find all the links that we've talked about and links to all these projects. We love getting feedback, so please let us know how we're doing by one of the following.
You can email us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/forgotmindice. We post all our articles there, so feel free to comment. Or you can message us directly via Facebook Messenger.
We also have a Pinterest page where, among other things, we post articles along with other cool stuff we find. You can find us and message us there at pinterest.com/forgotmydice.
We also have Facebook comments enabled for all our articles at forgotmydice.com.
You can message us or tweet us on the Twitters. Find us at forgotmydice.
If you like the show, the best way for more people to find out about us is to give us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher.
Lastly, for those of you listening to us from the Wizarding World, send your owls to forgotmydice.
The Wizarding World?
Yeah, they listen to podcasts on crystal balls.
Okay. Now it's time for our discussion topic of the show, and tonight, instead of a review, we're actually going to be discussing a very interesting topic, and that is high-level Dungeons & Dragons play. Robert, let's talk a little bit about why we're talking about this particular topic.
One of the things that when you own a website, you get to see is like what people are actually looking at on your website. And one thing that we have gotten very consistent hits on for since it was posted last January was Gina and I wrote an article called Campaign Postmortem, D&D 5th Edition, and the Shackled City Adventure Path. And that was basically our review for the month, where I basically reviewed 5th Edition and Shackled City. But a lot of it, you know, I wrote it after we finished the campaign. And thus, the stuff that happened later in the campaign was much more fresh on my mind than the stuff that happened very early in the campaign. High level play was like a thing. It was a thing I was struggling with. And we get a lot of people looking at that, and we get a lot of people, you know, just typing in high level D&D and finding the site that way.
Well, so, and it's an interesting topic because it's clearly something that, as well tested as Dungeons and Dragons 5th Edition was, it's definitely a glaring hole in their testing, because it's pretty easy to say that it's slightly, if not massively, broken in favor of the players in a major way.
It depends on what you want. I was thinking about this earlier today. One of my problems with high level play was games set up expectations, and especially because video games are a thing. So when you talk about, shall we say, a boss monster or a boss encounter, this guy who's supposed to be the leader of this scary band and a crazy, crazy awesome person, I started getting into just the problem that my players were killing them in a round and a half.
Happens a lot earlier than you'd expect. So let's kind of define what we mean by high level D&D, and that is pretty much any play level at level 10 or above for your player characters.
Yeah. Level 10, if that number sounds familiar, think to yourself, what have the last three D&D storylines stopped at? Out of the Abyss, Curse of Strahd, and Storm King's Thunder are all supposed to cap out at around level 10, like level 10 to 12 is where they're supposed to cap out. And that is not a coincidence.
I don't think so at all. In fact, I think that is categorically an almost admission of guilt in regards to the problem. So let's talk about what the problem is. And that is, of course, the huge power creep that occurs in player characters once you exceed level 10.
I noticed it first at level 12. At level 12, it really and I don't know what it was. It was, well, I mean, they obviously got new abilities and new spells and whatnot, but that was the one where I noticed a jump where my players suddenly seemed much more capable than they were at level 11. And I don't know what it is. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it just seemed like a level 12 encounter was not threatening them at all.
In fact, having played a couple of the story modules with my groups in the past, I can even say that even though it gets very noticeable at level 10, I think that power creep starts really at about level 3 is when you start to see these large jumps in power. And it just seems like, at least with the published modules, they're not doing the best job of attuning the difficulty to that player power.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said about where do you set the power curve at? Because some people are going to make very, very optimized characters because that's the way they like playing. They like making, shall we say, correct choices if that's the way you like doing it. And then there's some people that just sort of play for fun and just do wacky things for the sake of doing wacky things. And, you know, some people who want to play with an idea and don't really care if it's not the best idea in the world.
So now, Robert, do you personally see this as a problem with the system in general, or do you see this as a problem with the modules that have been published?
I see it as a problem with playtesting, because overall I think every character class can get about to the same level of insanity if you build it right. And in my game, I had three characters that were built right, and then I had two characters that were not built as optimally. And the three characters that were, you know, really good were all, they did things differently, but they were all kind of at the same plateau, it felt like, at least from my end of the screen. And then the other two characters, they also felt very similarly, you know, power curved. So I think the game's at a spot, more or less, at least on the player's side, where things are fine. For me, it was obvious that what they gave monsters in terms of hit points was pretty much just not enough once you got north of level 10.
So let's talk about some solutions now. I mean, if we've identified the problem, we've identified kind of the cause. So let's start solutioning here.
It's one of those things like, what do you want for your players? For me, I mean, a lot of my thoughts came out of the idea of, you know, boss monsters and people that are supposed to be threats, that it's like, oh, this is a big scary guy who's like the head of this cult. And then you just like breathe on him heavy and he dies. I was not satisfied with that. But, you know, some people don't care. Some people like that idea. Some people, you know, want to have that feeling. And so what all of this is going to boil down to is what do you want out of your high level game? And my two solutions that I saw are the game kind of figures players will just basically have a lot of encounters that will slowly wear them down. And a lot of fifth edition systems are based off of a survey they did back when they did third edition, which was trying to figure out how RPG players actually play, you know, because second edition D&D, you know, you need like 16 million XP to get to level 20, whereas, you know, a goblin gave you 20 XP. So, you know, you'd have to go on the goblin genocide to get to level 20. And because of that, nobody really played at higher levels because you just couldn't get to them because it would literally take you years to level up. So they're like, well, how do people actually play? And I remember the survey when it came out, because they talked about the results pretty extensively in Dragon Magazine, because this was before the internet. You know, they said most people play 4-hour sessions are the average. Most people play for about 8 months. And so they designed the game that if you play for 4 hours for 8 months every week, you will get to level 20. And the game still seems to be built around that idea. And you can see it in the XP tables. You can see it in the long and short rest thing. The idea is that you should have, in any given game session before you take a long rest, you should have 2 to 4 encounters. Typically 4 is what they base the idea around. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. The game's designed around that idea. But in actual reality, that's a nice theory, but it doesn't always happen. For example, my level 12 party was rolling around the abyss like you do during, you know, Shackled City, because what happens at high level D&D, you go to hell because that's just what you do. And they encountered a black dragon that was challenge rating, I want to say 14 or 15. It was not the oldest one. It was the second oldest one. It's supposed to be a hard fight. In theory, that should eat up 25% of their resources fighting this black dragon.
Sure.
And the black dragon was 2 levels above them at a minimum. And they got it down to a point where it was supposed to flee, because the rules say if it gets to less than this amount of HP, it's going to take off, because it's like better to live and fight another day. And they did that in one round, because they were like, oh, a dragon, we'll just blow everything we got and go take a long rest because we can do that for the sake of this plot. The solution to my problem was I just started giving things more hit points.
Well, and I think that's an important solution to call out, right? you are the dungeon master or the game master in whatever system that you're doing, because this is something that we'll see in a lot of systems. I mean, we're calling out Dungeons and Dragons, but that's definitely something that happens in a lot of RPG systems once you're starting to get into upper levels. As the dungeon master or the game master, it's your responsibility to keep things fun, and it's your responsibility to keep things balanced. And I think one of the ways that you can do that is not taking the monsters verbatim out of the book.
I can see people, you know, they spent a lot of money on this shiny book and they want to like use it. And that's the thing. The monster statistics, other than the hit points, are actually very good, because the dragon's breath weapon is scary and they have a lot of cool abilities.
It should be scary. It's a giant dragon.
Right. It was just very clear to me that in a 5-player party, they did not have enough hit points. You're going to find problems like this in any role-playing game you play, because the problem with any form of playtesting in a game like this ever, it's not like a video game. You know, it's not like there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, most D&D games are very open-ended. And so when you get handed the keys to a playtest packet, you're going to roll up new characters and you're going to start playing. But the problem is, for every sort of successive level or however they track how you get XP, the less and less likely are that people are going to get that far to report back to you about what's working and what's not. And so, I mean, it's D&D's problem. It's pretty obvious north of level 10, a lot of this stuff wasn't tested as well, because just not enough people did it.
So, I mean, I guess that's the thing that you walk away from this particular part of the discussion with, which is don't be afraid to exercise your right as a DMGM and, you know, fudge monsters to make them more interesting. That can be extra hit points. That can be extra abilities. You know, that can be setbacks to the party based on environmental conditions. Just make it fun and make it appropriate for the monster.
Oh, what I would say to this is, in the 90s, those of us who kind of grew up with second and third edition D&D, monsters in general during that period of time were designed around the idea that they have rules that mimic that of the characters. That is a very, very bad place to be in, because the creatures that you are fighting are not characters. They're not supposed to be characters. And to think that you would function off of the exact same rule set with the exact same rules, I think is a poor idea. You know, the whole D&D idea that, okay, so this monster has this many hit dice, so you just roll this many D12s to figure out its hit dice, you know, and there's some sort of mathematic equation to all of it. I don't think a lot of more modern role-playing games have been getting away from that lately. And D&D has, 5th edition has to an extent. For those of us who are about my age, who have been playing role-playing games for a while, it's really hard to crack yourself out of the notion that the monsters have to play by the same rules as the players, or else it won't be fair. Because players have several advantages over any monster you can throw at them, one of which is there's 5 of them and they get to attack in a random order, where the monster typically gets to go once, which is, you know, D&D tried to solve that with layer actions and legendary actions, so the monster would go more than once. Just don't think that you have to hold your monster to that rule. Like, give the monster just extra hit points. Who cares? Raise its difficulty. This dragon has a backstory. I'm supposed to be awesome. D&D gives it a proficiency bonus of +5, but this is an awesome dragon, so I'm going to give it a proficiency bonus of +7 and just raise all of its rolls by +2, because why not? The monsters do not have to function under the same restrictions as a player does. They're monsters. Make the fight fun. Make it... I don't know any player that's going to say, it's like, oh, look at that awesome dragon that we almost killed in one round.
Yeah,
I sure feel good about that fight.
The best moments in any role-playing game, and this goes for games in general, are where you pull out that miraculous moment by the skin of your teeth, because that means that you've overcome a challenge. And I think that's where the meat is for a lot of people, right?
Yeah, you just don't have to have the same rules for monsters as characters. And if you want to, that's cool. I mean, I'm not saying you're awful or whatever for doing it, but it is not a requirement. Make that your choice. If you're going to do that and you're going to run the monster manual verbatim, like, own that, do it, use it for all it's worth. But, you know, if you don't like the way things are, yeah, like, do not be afraid to just say this thing has 200 extra HP because.
Yeah. Well,
and you don't have to like reconfigure its hit points. It's like, okay, so 200 extra hit points. It's like, oh, it gets a D12 for its hit dice, and then it gets its con bonus, so it gets 8. So it gets 8.5 hit points on the average dice, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, so it actually has this many hit dice extra. It's like, no, just give it 200. Don't worry about the math. The only person seeing the math is you.
Well, and you're especially encouraged to do this right in the text of the Dungeon Master's Guide. So on page 4 of the Dungeon Master's Guide, it very specifically says, and I'm quoting straight from the book here, The D&D rules help you and other players have a good time, but the rules aren't in charge. You're the DM, and you are in charge of the game. That said, your goal isn't to slaughter the adventurers, but to create a campaign world that revolves around their actions and decisions, and to keep your players coming back for more. So that says it all to me. I mean, that's the ultimate license to have fun with the world and the characters.
Another thing I would say, just to shake things up, because also the other problem with high-level D&D is that the Monster Manual is really focused around lower-level threats. And so once you start getting past level 10, you're just like, I don't actually have a lot of monsters I can run because there isn't as much stuff up here as there is down there. One of the ways I was getting around that is I cannot tell you how many archmages my players fought. There was at least 1 to 2 in every adventure I was running out of the Shackled City. But the beauty of the Shackled City adventure path was they gave you all of those mages that I was converting into monsters. They give them stats in the back of the book, including what magic items they were holding. When you roll random loot, like, why would the boss, orc or whatever, leave a magic sword in a box? Like, give it to him and give him the bonus. A sword plus one is a sword plus one, or a sword that, you know, is on fire and does an extra D6 of fire damage. Don't have your players like find that sword and then have to like try to figure out what it is. You know, the orcs would probably already have done that. The orcs are not that intelligent. They would pick it up and try to whack each other with it to see if it cursed them or caught in fire and did extra damage. So, you know, give that to your boss orc because it makes that encounter more memorable. And, you know, then you don't have loot lying around. Then you've pried loot from the cold, dead fingers of your enemies. And that's always more awesome.
What about the problem of skill creep? When the skills start to get really, really good and you start having dice checks for basically what amounts to a nothing for the player character.
Fifth edition's better about that because proficiency bonus plus stat is caps out at plus 11 for every character. That being said, for 5th edition, the skill range is fixed. You don't have like the 3rd edition problem where, you know, it's like, oh, we're playing a 15th level adventure, so this door has a lockpick skill of 50 plus to open. The lock quantities are like 10, 15, 20. It's set in stone. What I would say is there just kind of comes a certain point in every adventurer's career where, to be honest, why are you making them roll for things anymore? For example, a DC 15, which is kind of the average 15 or the average number for any sort of skill check in D&D. If somebody who is proficient at it and has a high enough stat is rolling against that, they'll fail it on a roll of 1, 2, or 3. Why are you bothering to roll at that point? Near the tail end of my 5th edition game, I had started reading Gumshoe because I was starting to prep for the next thing I was going to run. It really became clear not giving your players information is kind of lame, especially in pre-published adventures. They take the time to give you a lot of fluff. And when players roll and roll poorly, you're denying them fluff. You're denying them things that get them into this world and give things context and give things coolness, where it's like, oh, you walk up to this church. It's like, oh, dwarf, roll your stone check, blah, 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 because why not? And, oh, I rolled a 2. You had this cool paragraph of, oh, well, this architecture was from this age, and obviously this dwarf built it and blah, blah, blah. But now you don't get to read that because they failed a roll. That whole train of thought was the genesis of Mysteries Incorporated, which was an article I wrote for Scooby-Doo Month. There just comes a point where it's like rolling skill checks, especially for fluff, for knowledge checks, just seems counterintuitive, especially when giving information makes things better. Mike talked about it in the review last episode, where nothing's worse in investigative role playing than failing a skill check and the players just not getting a bit of information that would have helped them and was necessary for them to complete the game. And he came up with a way to get around that by just allowing you to do flashbacks and doing other things to fudge your roles. And then Gumshoe just kind of assumes that you just get all that stuff all the time. And especially for information like that, especially at high levels when rolling is not really an issue anymore. Mm-hmm. Why even bother? Just give the players information. If the skill is at a point where the players need to roll an 11 or higher, that's maybe when you have them roll. Also, a lot of skill things in D&D, they have information sort of on a continuum where it's like, if you roll a 10, you can tell them this. And if you roll a 15, you can tell them this. And if you roll a whatever, tell them this. You might as well tell them the first thing or two, because why not? And if you want them to roll, or if they want to follow that thread, that's when you have the player roll to see if they can find anything else out and get that like nugget on top. and maybe they'll devote more time to investigate it because they failed that skill roll. And they're like, oh, I'm going to take some time to figure this little bit of information out, but it's engagement and whatnot. So,
well, and I think with skill checks in general, you can make them more interesting by incorporating pieces of the environment into it. I mean, if you want to keep running skill checks like that they might by some slim chance fail, that's certainly okay. But have a thematic reason for why that's happening, right? Let's say you're in a very loud tavern and the table next to you has a bunch of drunk people at it and they're screaming and laughing and it's making it very hard to concentrate. And maybe that's why you're going to make perhaps not remember what you're trying to remember and fail a knowledge check or something along those lines, right? Use thematic reasons why you're still continuing to do what would amount to a potentially mindless skill check.
Or use the philosophy of failing forward, which is you go to pick lock of door X or Y and you fail. So it's like, eh, whatever, you pick the lock. But now instead of the room on the other side being empty, you know, the orcs from two rooms over just happen to be there and happen to hear your fumbling attempts to pick the lock loudly and are now ready for you. And you don't get to get the drop on them. And your rogue doesn't get to use his cool sneak attack abilities and his assassination stuff because, oh, the orcs are waiting for you. They were just, you open the door and they're just sitting there smiling at you and then they charge.
Exactly. There's a lot of different ways to handle it. But just at the end of the day, I think it all comes down to one thing. You're the DM. You're in charge. And it's simultaneously your responsibility to give the players a good time and a good challenge. And you know, balance it out with what you have prepared or what you have in your pre-generated module. So use your flexibility as the GM and alter things, change things, make environmental reasons why things are happening. You know, give enemies buffs, give enemies more hit points, whatever it takes to balance it out for your player set. And you know, communicate with your players too. At the end of sessions, have conversations about what happened, right? Feel out what they like, because every group's going to be a little different.
Yeah, and maybe your players like fighting slog after slog of little guys expending their resources. And if that's their thing, like maybe you've invested several thousand dollars into dungeon tiles and you have this gigantic dungeon mapped out and you guys are just playing through it more like a miniatures combat game than, you know, D&D. That, if that's their thing and they're having a good time, like, yeah, roll with it. If I'm making your skin crawl, don't pay attention to me. But I think the thing to take away from any discussion about high-level D&D is just what high-level D&D is. It operates under a certain amount of presets, and honestly, that four encounters thing, it starts going out the window north of level 10, because the dungeon where I wore my players down, it had what I would consider four boss battles, which I didn't buff overly much, but they were still supposed to be pretty hard, and then it had another 23 rooms that were guarded by something. And be aware of that, because they did all 23 of those rooms without taking a long rest at level, I want to say 17. And they got to the last battle and it was pretty hairy. I managed to almost kill two people. Actually, I didn't kill half the party failed saves and got suggested to walk out of the dungeon, which was awesome. So it left two players to face down this big bad demon. And one of the players managed to get their hands on a staff and is like, you know what happens in D&D when you break cool name staves? Bad things. So I'm going to bust this thing over my head and try to blow me and this demon up, because all of the other players have had to run out of this room due to demon suggestions. But that made a cool story, because at the end of it, they were like, oh my God, this was awful and we're about to die and there's this demon that's crazy. So I don't know. Maybe that just proved my point that I don't know what I'm talking about. But whatever. Just be aware of what's going on, because D&D does require a certain amount of just wearing players down if you're going to run stuff out of the monster manual. And then you get into the whole problem of they're still getting XP for all that. And by the book XP, they might be leveling faster than you intend, because, you know, it's like, oh my God, I actually do have to have 17 encounters in this dungeon before they can get to the thing I want them to think is scary because I have to wear them down. But that's 17 things that they're getting XP for, which is why I'm very glad I just used the milestone system and didn't worry about it.
Yeah, I definitely would make the same suggestion. I would say get rid of individual XP and just use the milestone system, because it definitely, in my experience, has helped me balance out my encounters and player progression a lot better.
Well, by balancing out, meaning you don't have to worry about it.
yeah, exactly.
You don't have to set your budget and like, I can't have any more than this because I don't want them to be level, you know, above this level because the adventure I'm running doesn't want them to be.
Exactly. I find it more fun from a DMGM's perspective as well, because it lets you have more flexibility, because then you can throw whatever you want at them And there's no repercussion on from a power creep perspective.
In the article, when I'm making my case for why milestones are good, I suggest using this leveling system for any adventure series you plan on converting. Plus, if players are rewarded for completing adventures and not just killing everything in sight, they might choose to talk their way through conflicts. Sure, my group didn't, but yours might. This is the other thing to watch out for at high-level D&D. At high-level D&D, the players have a lot of options to do things. For example, in the Shackled City game, the players become aware that this evil cultist group has called sort of a meet with all of the local crime lords. And the players obviously wanted to go bust this up, like you do. So the adventure assumes that you would do the logical thing and walk through the front door and fight the guards in the front door and then the guards on the second floor and then go, you know, bust up this like, you know, evil criminal empire thing. But players being what they are, you can't account for that because these players were, you know, they were north of level 15. And I got this groovy book that had a bunch of third party book back when before the OGL existed. So it was very unofficial, but it was a book of spells and it had some fun spells in it. And my druid found a spell called Chariot of Fire, which is you summon a flying chariot made out of frickin' fire that you can fly around for funsies. They were all rested up. They heard about this meet. They were like, well, we could do the logical thing and sneak in and try to take these guys unawares, or we could cast Chariot of Fire and then just fly. GM Robert, you said there was an observatory with a telescope on top of this house, right? I'm like, yes, it's in this adventure. Yes. Yeah. I was describing the house. There's a big old observatory. And what is the top of this observatory made out of? It's like, oh, it's this glass dome. Good, good. We're going to cast Chariot of Fire. We're all going to saddle up. They queued up Flight of the Valkyries on one of their phones, played that and said, we're going to go fly into the frickin' observatory on our Chariot of Fire and beat our way down to this meeting. Because surprise, who cares about the surprise? We're high-level players. And yes, that is also something at high-level play you have to watch out for. Players will be feeling themselves out and have a lot of cool abilities, and they're going to use them in interesting ways, and you have to be prepared to deal with that. And I was like, well, you know what? It's end of the game, or it's getting close to the end of the game. You guys went and did something stupid. Let's do this. And so they did what in World of Warcraft terms was pulled the entire dungeon. And basically I looked at all the NPCs and a couple of them they said would run if they got the opportunity. So I figured, okay, giant chariot of fire crashing into the top of this building, those guys would probably run. But everybody else rushed up there along with everybody's guards and they got into what amounted to a Marvel hallway sequence.
Nice.
Just fighting their way down into this meeting room and just killing people the whole way down like an old boy or something. Just murdering their whole way down this house. Here's the thing. That fight was not designed to do that. They almost died because there were a lot of things they were fighting. But rules as written in the DM's guide, they have multipliers if you're fighting a lot of monsters because they've got rules for that because, of course, they do. It's D&D. Mm-hmm. And I tallied that up based off of, you know, just rules as written and what was there and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And they would have gained like two levels from that fight because the multiplier for that many things was so high. That's something you also got to watch out for because high level players are going to do things. And if you react appropriately and you're playing rules as written, they might get a level up or two just by doing something stupid. And they might have the ability because, as we mentioned, you know, if they can expend all of their resources, they can expend a lot of resources to overcome that. Because I got two players down pretty far. They were in a bad spot and then they won. High level D&D is crazy. You got to think on your feet. And I think the easiest thing as a GM, as a dungeon master, you can do is do not look at those rules and think they are sacred, because there are interactions you will get at a high level D&D that they did not account for and will just, I don't want to say wreck your game, but it might put your characters at a place that you were just not anticipating them, you know, getting, where it's like, oh, they got a level up because they did something awesome, but it's not what you intended. And now you got to like reconjigger the back half of a session because now the players have an extra level under their belt and are, you know, destroying things even more so than they were before. And that's all I got to say about that.
So that concludes our brief discussion on, you know, working with high-level D&D players. You know, for more information, definitely take a look at the article at ForgotMyDice.com. We'll put a link directly to that article in the show notes.
In the full show notes, yes.
Yeah. And that actually brings us to the end of episode 4 of the Forgot My Dice podcast. As always, join us on all of our electronic discussion forums, where we love to interact with you and hear from you and your thoughts on the subject. Robert, any final thoughts to share with the group tonight?
Yes, two. I've been fooling around with show notes the entire time we've been making this. I think I've settled on something I like, so I am putting links to everything in what I'm calling the full show notes, because if I put them into the podcast thing, it'll show up on your podcast player, and it's really annoying, and it looks terrible. But the full show notes are on our website. So if any of these Kickstarters sounded fun, if you're looking for the article, whatever, just click on, you know, episode 4, full show notes, boom, that's where all of this stuff will be. And one last thing, like I said, if anybody cares about hearing me ramble about old D&D campaign settings, I will try to actually say interesting things. And by that, I'll probably scour the couple of issues of Dragon Magazine that I still held on to that have a whole bunch of like information about the making of these campaign settings and whatnot. But if anybody cares, let us know, because I can talk about it. I found that podcast interesting. I don't know. So if you want to hear my thoughts on the matter or talk about setting and story beats and whatnot, yeah, let us know. I'm interested, but I don't know if anybody else is.
That brings us to the end of Forgot My Dice episode 4. So until 2 more weeks go by and you get episode 5, be excellent to one another and party on.
Party on.
The music you heard in this podcast was Intro by Elephiu and Retro Funk by Persephone, both used with permission via the Creative Commons license.